Yes, Santa Cruz, welcome to the Cannabis Connection. I'm your host, Christopher Carr. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of Santa Cruz Cannabis Talk Radio. Giving thanks for another day in paradise. It's December. We're wrapping up another year. Every opportunity is a blessing to broadcast here and to build community in cannabis. I'm very excited for our guest this evening, Luna Whitcomb. Luna is an all-organic living soil probiotic natural farmer and grower, writer for Skunk Magazine, and administrator for cannabis education groups. She specializes in soil biology and homemade plant input making. From ferments to extracts and enzymes, Luna's methodology focuses on plant health and vigor. Very excited for the show. Welcome to the Cannabis Connection.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Hi, thank you so much. Can you tell the people where in the world are you joining us this evening?
So I'm in Central Oregon.
Righteous. Welcome. Well, this is very exciting because I've been a fan of yours for some time. And can you speak a little bit to your roots in cultivating this wonderful plant? Like, how did you get to this pursuit, this way of life of taking care of a garden?
Well, I've been growing cannabis for 14 years. excuse me, I'm just getting over COVID. But I found a real passion in connecting with nature and implementing the systems that nature has kind of evolved to optimize, like, our plant growth and provide a really superior product that is topographically unique to an area that is real medicine, that carries characteristics that are healing and calming and full of aroma. I find the sciences behind soil and behind plants and fungi and microbes, bacteria, and everything surrounding those concepts to be extremely fascinating. And it brings me closer to the earth, and I feel very connected to it. And it brings me joy to create something that's special to other people to consume and to enjoy.
Wow, beautiful. That was like poetry. Yeah, I agree. Scene, like, man, give thanks for that. And Oregon, can you speak a little bit about Oregon? We have family in Southern Oregon, and then our dear cousin moved up to Portland, and we've had a few guests on the show. One recent guest was Brandon Potter, living up in Bend, Oregon, and I watch what you're up to and the elements, and you obviously there's a little bit different temperature and patterns compared to the central coast of California or Northern California. In some ways, Southern Oregon's very similar, kind of like State of Jefferson zone. But can you speak to the patterns and the cycles and how it is growing up in Oregon compared to maybe where our audience is most used to in California?
Yeah, sure. So I'm actually in Bend, coincidentally.
Oh, how
enough,
cool.
But,
okay, yeah. Great. Yeah.
I didn't know that he was from Bend, so I'm going to have to reach out to him.
You should. He's an amazing scientist with the, especially fungal science of, yeah, he taught me a lot about botrytis.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So I actually grew up in California. Born in California. I lived in California for like 20 years of my life. And I cultivated in Northern California in Central and in Northern California, as well as Southern Oregon and Central Oregon. So I've kind of been all over the West Coast of the United States, doing cultivation. So I'm familiar with like the different, environments and,
oh, cool.
and the climates and like how they respond to things and how you kind of have to treat them a little bit differently. Central Oregon is hard. It's probably the most difficult place that I've had to grow in. People take for granted the environment and the soil quality that is in like Northern California and Southern Oregon. It's a lot more dry here. It's extremely dry. You know, you'll get lower than 10% humidity most of the time around here. And it gets really hot in the summer. It gets really cold in the winter. So there's kind of just like extremes that you have to really keep in mind. well, of course, you know, on the coast, any kind of coastal region, you know, you're going to have like really high humidity and you're going to have to deal with, you know, like your powdery mildews and your botrytis and your just like fungal pathogens in general, right? You know, those molds really like to grow out there and implementing concepts like competitive exclusion, like with microbes and beneficial, fungi or endophytes or whatnot, you know, becomes more crucial there. It's a difficult dance when it comes to fighting the biology that you don't want, right?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, and trying to encourage the good stuff.
Yeah, encourage the good stuff. Competitive exclusion, right? So this concept of competitive exclusion is implementing, integrating beneficial biology, beneficial microbes. And microbes are fungi, bacteria, you know, endophytes, you know, spores, all these living organisms. They're all kind of under this umbrella term of microbe, right? So we're integrating with these beneficial microbes that can occupy space within within nature,
yeah.
Within, you know, on the root systems, on the leaf surfaces, on the stems, you know, in the soil. So, you know, there's a certain amount of space that can be occupied, right, before you hit capacity, right? So we're trying to competitively exclude pathogenic biology with beneficial biology. So we integrate beneficial biology that becomes symbiotic with the plant, and we nurture it to outcompete the things that are going to cause harm to our plant. So that's an advantage of teaming up with nature and teaming up with biology that really can't be understated. It's a super important concept in organic, regenerative, probiotic farming practices.
Yeah, well, and we had I really appreciated chatting earlier today, and I'd love to kind of maybe segue a bit into the process of, especially when we were thinking about opening up the show today. I loved your bio and your intro of stewarding the soil in such a way to encourage the best hormones and the best environment for plant growth and that kind of symbiotic living soil food web,
sure.
And simple best practices to help along with that, because it's really fun to you know, just learn these very approachable, you know, best practices and to learn, you know, from someone like yourself that I've watched the videos, I've watched the shows. Would love to share this with the audience.
Yeah, definitely. So what we're doing here is we're nurturing life, right? Biology is life. It is the foundation of life. Plants are alive. There are universal concepts surrounding life, you know, cellular health, you know, single-celled organisms, fungi, you know, all these things. We're all organisms. We're all a collective symbiotic relationship between life and cells, and breaking down to the, you know, chemical structures of these things, you know, what does life need? And it can be broken down into pretty simple a list of needs. What we're doing is we're finding what life needs, and we're giving it to it. We're finding where life is deficient in what it requires to thrive, and we encourage it, we nurture it, right? So, you know, we have our nutrients, which is a lot of the big aspect that people focus on is, you know, we have our main micro and macronutrients. But we also have our amino acids, our carbon-based chains, our carboxylic acids, our chains of carbons that create organic acids. They create amino acids, which then create proteins and enzymes. All these things are carbon, but we maximize the integration of organic acids and amino acids and these wide profiles of enzymes, amino acids, organic acids, and let biology build itself through what it needs. And this is also affected by our climate, our soil composition. So we introduce the components to allow life to thrive. And then we let life just kind of take care of itself, right? And so this is also, we integrate our food sources. We integrate polysaccharides, which are complex carbohydrates. They're types of sugars. Polysaccharides, they're the most abundant energy source in nature. It's how everything is fueled, and based on the polysaccharides, based on the profile of organic acids inside of the soil, the composition of organic matter kind of outlines what biology is going to exist inside of that soil. And when that biology comes in contact with other compounds, for example, a lower fungi, maybe something like Aspergillus or Leucor, comes in contact with a specific organic acid, it then ferments that organic acid, and it can turn it into another carbon-based chain that is a phytohormone, for example, an auxin, right? And these auxins or other amino acids, or I'm sorry, organic acids, they play roles when interacting with root zones and with plants that promote different processes in the plants, specifically things like metabolic pathways and your flavonoid pathways, which then lead to different aroma profiles and strength of aroma coming from a plant. So when we introduce this diversity of compounds that nurtures this diversity of life, this life is now creating all these different phytohormones that contribute specific properties to the plant. Another example is a stress response hormone that people see a lot of terpene percentage increase when in contact with jasmonic acid. The plants are then exposed to them, and we get this new expression of secondary metabolites, this new expression of sulfur based molecules and of terpenes and different volatile compounds that really bring out the full genetic expression of the plant that we're cultivating, whether it be cannabis or a tomato. When we provide the full foundation for what life needs, we give it like the maximum potential to express itself, the best that it can. And I think that can really translate to all life, right?
Yeah.
That translates to all life, you know? And that's kind of how I try to live my life and how I try to treat my plants.
It's powerful. It's a powerful metaphor. I really appreciate all of that sentiment and the example. That's a piece here, even ongoing. And thinking medicinally, I encountered a situation. A friend of mine moved away, but is part of a mom group locally. And to this day, patients are trying to find ways to connect with medicinally minded cannabis aficionados, and sometimes they have very wholesome basic questions on stewarding their own medical gardens and stewarding their own health, and would love to hear from you about some of the like basic most like easy ways for, because that was a wonderful overview, but how can maybe a novice or a layman further that relationship in deepening the potential for success, the potential for that expression of that plant to come to fruition? Is it focusing on the soil? Is it focusing on the genetics? Is it part of all three? And also obviously paying attention to kind of how we open the show, what grows best in that area and the natural factors that the elements provide. I think that's really important. I would love to hear your thoughts on, because this is a timely topic that came up this week with patients wondering what to do, and they're going to shops and spending too much, and they want some agency.
So Such a great question. So, you know, everything plays its own role, right? You need good genetics. You need healthy soil. You need good biology. I think the first thing first is to build well-balanced soil. And then to integrate biology, to find a quality inoculant, a quality biological input that you introduce to your soil, to help nutrient cycling, to build your soil food web. There are a few different ways of making nutrients readily available. There are a few different concepts. This is called chelation, right? Where nutrients can be made readily available through like covalent bonds with like humic and fulvic acid, amino acids, and enzymes to make things readily available. This is mostly done through plant processes by root exudates. We can also take matters into our own hands and introduce them through like ferments and stuff. So I think your question was a big question.
It's broad. You mentioned something. I would like to digress a little. When you mentioned ferments, are these like the compost teas that we see online, or maybe you could define some of these things, because it might be, this is, we're in a fun time to think about soil on the Central Coast. We're probably most yardeners, backyard growers, are in a kind of reflective time thinking about their season. Maybe the crop is in, it's dried, we're in that post-harvest workflow, but maybe there's some things we can do for the beds, or for the wherever the plot is, or containers, or you know, kind of all of the, you know, I'm curious about these ferments and even like a little breakdown of like, you know, how does someone start?
So ferments can be tailored for specific goals.
Nice.
There's multiple types of ferments, right? We have ferments that are kind of done through osmotic pressure or started with osmotic pressure. Those are like your salts and your sugar. They have a high osmotic pressure. They pull juices out. They trigger enzymatic processes. They ferment, make things readily available. Depending on what you're fermenting, will depend on what is readily available. If you use like a legume or a like high protein source, when you ferment it, you will have amino acids that are available. Amino acids are the foundation for so many processes in life. You know, you can do like a lactobacillus-based ferment, which will make your whatever your inputs are more nutrient available. Like you can have a nutrient source through doing lactobacillus-based ferments. There's also like tincturing, which is better for your polyphenols and your polysaccharides. They kind of keep them intact a little bit more so that you can introduce a diversity of food sources. Fermenting happens in the soil.
Cool.
A ferment is often considered something that you put in a bucket with an airlock. And like, you know, you ferment it or, you know, like beer or wine, people often think that's fermentation. Fermentation is just the changing of one chemical compound through biology to another one. So that happens in the soil a lot, and fermentation processes create a massive, massive diversity of amino or of organic acids that have a huge range of effects on plants and biology surrounding them. So fermentation is this really broad concept, and it isn't just done, you know, you can ferment with aspergillus if you want to. You can do solid state ferments where they're not even liquid. You know, you are introducing, you know, like a lactic acid bacteria serum to some kind of grain carbohydrate, you know, and this is the process for making something like bokashi, where you're top dressing it to encourage these lower fungal balloons, these lower fungal body balloons like mucor and zygomycetes, that will then, you know, make connections with like mycorrhizal networks and extend like the reach of root zones to make nutrients more readily available to a root system over like a distance, or, you know, increase the surface area of it. So did you want to talk like specifics to like how to make some of these inputs, some of these ferments and stuff?
Yeah. Well, yeah, why not? I mean, just a basic, maybe like maybe just an overall health tonic or key things. I know there's so many. You mentioned some really interesting natural farming thing, bokashi. It's a lot to get into. I know each one we could speak for an hour, but yeah, why not? Maybe we could think about people where they're sure. at and something they can do proactively.
Sure. And I apologize if I'm talking too big.
I love it. No, it's really fascinating, and I love the approach because it's this holistic approach to health and providing the needs. And a lot of what I witness online is these gorgeous beds. You know, having some, you have a really beautiful classroom that you're kind of showcasing. And so it's interesting to think, because I think a lot of people maybe do beds. We've had issues here in California with drought, with gophers. So people are really kind of aligned with that approach. And I'm personally in a spot too in our backyard, like thinking about making more garden space and what can I do? And we have cover crop and we had some water, and there's some water coming, some rain precipitation, so I'm wondering what I could do too to help nature along.
So are you familiar with Korean natural farming?
Yes, we've had Chris Trump on once. It was a long time ago.
Great.
Yeah, so we've gone deep before, and Wendy came on, and please continue. I love Korean natural farming.
So I think Korean natural farming is a really great like first step to jump in to learning how to make your own ferments and stuff.
Awesome.
And your own tinctures and your own very low cost, like simple, inoculants and ferments that you can then integrate, you know, and they bring out amino acids, and phytohormones and enzymes, and the system is very complete, you know, so they have their, they use a lot of brown sugar, which I'm not a super big fan of, but I think that this is a very great place to get started. And so they ferment fish with brown sugar to create their amino acid source. I don't want to get too into how to make it. It's pretty in-depth, and I think that people should do reading on it.
Yeah.
But it does involve mixing, you know, fish carcasses and brown sugar and letting ferment for a number of months until certain characteristics come about. And then, so that's your amino acid source, right? I personally follow different ways of bringing out amino acids. You know, I like to use aloe vera, which has a much wider profile of amino acids. I'm
wow.
very big into like a diversity of inputs, like full profiles of inputs. So I prefer aloe vera. You know, aloe vera and fish are nowhere near the same, right? One has a lot more fats, you know, one's going to have more, like different vitamins, right? They just have, they're very different, right? One's a plant and one's a fish.
Yeah.
So they have different like times when they're better, like best to be implemented. These are all just like tools in our toolbox, right? And I encourage everyone to learn as many tools as possible. But it all really comes down to amino acids, enzymes, an inoculant source, your micro, your macronutrients, and feeding it to really thrive. So they also go into, they use brown sugar to make fermented plant juices, where they'll take local plant inputs, like local plants growing in your native environment, and they'll chop them into pieces and then, you know, mix it with equal weights brown sugar and kind of crush it up and stuff, like masticize it a little bit. And and then let it ferment for like a week, and it'll separate into these juices. And these juices are very rich in enzymes and organic acids which then introduced to the soil are again fermented by the biology in the soil to help promote phytohormones, plant hormones that will bring out certain characteristics, like increased growth or better fruiting, increased metabolic processes, you know, flavonoid pathways, things like that that I had mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And so that's a good way to introduce these organic acids and stuff. I've been getting into just like collecting native plants, weeds, different parts of plants, and just blending them up and straining them and
nice.
Adding them to a compost tea. I find it to just be easier, and it seems a little bit safer to me. Those fermented plant juices, they can be really strong.
Wow.
And they can actually, if not used correctly, they can cause damage. They're a very powerful tool. And just like every powerful tool, you know, you got to be careful when you're using it, because you can build something or you can destroy something.
Wow. So, yeah.
You know, be careful.
So the best practice might be to start low, go slow kind of thing, or just kind of observe.
Totally.
Yeah, just don't go too hard, obviously, because it's a balancing act.
Yeah, it really is. Don't underestimate nature, you know?
Yeah.
There's like this, sometimes people think that nature is like really soft, and it's not, you know? Mother nature has fangs, you know? Like,
oh, yeah.
You.
I've been humbled, so humbled. Yeah. Especially with cannabis cultivation can be very challenging. And elements too, right? With different things that can happen. And it's just providing that strong immune system and maintaining the healthy soil and keeping those things in check. I found diversity in my experience too is very important. Even plant diversity too, like the ground cover and having a biophilia. Maybe there's partner plants or, I guess it depends on the garden, but I really appreciate a village. Because the pests, too, are sometimes mitigated if you have other things involved. I was very surprised on that this year, just the diversity in the garden.
I love companion planting and living mulches.
Yes.
You know, so are you familiar with the concept of redox?
I don't know. No, probably not. I would love to learn.
So redox is, so there's like redox potential and then like there's like these redox levels. And one is the amount of free electrons that can exist in the soil. And then the other is how many actually free electrons are in the soil. So it's almost like the electrical charge of the soil. And this is created through root exudates of companion plants and the plants surrounding an area. So quite literally, the more energy in the soil, you know, is connected to how many plants have put energy into the soil through photosynthetic processes.
Whoa.
And
yeah,
root
charging
exudates.
It. Whoa.
Literally charging it, right?
From the sun, from their process. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, so these root exudates, they're secondary metabolites, they're the amino acids, enzymes, and carbohydrates that are secreted through the roots to communicate with elements around it, which then create bonding, covalent bonds that allow those nutrients to be readily available and then uptaken into the plant, right? So when you have a lot of companion planting, you don't want too much because you don't want to consume all the nutrients with your companion plants, and you don't want the roots to go too deep if you're trying to prioritize a particular plant, like cannabis, something with like a kind of shallow root zone, covering your area will increase all these, the levels of these secondary metabolites in the soil, making nutrients more available, also increasing, your redox potential and your amount of free electrons, which will then allow for nutrient uptake to happen much faster in your soil.
Yeah, supercharge.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are certain plants that are better at this than others. My favorite, it's a couple of my favorites. One that I really like to use is buckwheat. I did that in my garden a couple years ago, and I grew these massive plants. You can check it out on my Instagram if anyone cares to look. But I had these big, 12 foot tall, 15 foot wide cannabis plants that were pulling over 10 pounds a plant.
Wow.
And it was amazing. But I implemented, these concepts that I'm talking about, as well as companion planting, with the intention of having a home for biology. There are enzyme specific biology that attach to root exudates. So you're creating a home for biology, you're increasing nutrient availability, you're increasing, nutrient uptake. You're creating a home for beneficial insects. You're helping your bees in your surrounding area. One of the big things that we want to do is we want to make sure that we increase the health of the nature surrounding us, right? So we giving bees some food. We're just contributing to the health of the environment by adding more plants. And at times, if we want to add a diversity of plants, maybe just surrounding our garden, within our garden, not necessarily always within sharing the root zone with our cannabis plants. It really depends on what kind of plants, we don't want things to really compete with our cannabis.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, and I'm kind of getting off topic, but I'm excited about this thought. There's a lot of cool science behind, what creates a specific aroma in a plant and what encourages that specific aromatic profile. And a lot of it has to do with the profile of enzymes and organic acids and carbohydrates within the soil. And so there's some interesting studies and some interesting information that connects the that connects the profile of root exudates from a particular plant being taken on by a plant next to it.
It's like the neighborhood provides, it takes a village to make a smell in a flower almost. It's this working together in the soil, obviously, too.
And so through implementing ferments, which, are composed of these profiles of these secondary metabolites, we are encouraging our plants to take on that aroma. It encourages it, right? It's not going to smell exactly like it, right? But it encourages it to take it on. And doing companion planting also will encourage it to take on some of those aromas also by mimicking the root exudates that contribute to their aromatic development. So people talk about planting aromatic flowers within the root zone of their cannabis plants to bring out more floral notes and stuff
Wow. Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
It's very cool. I get nostalgic because some of the old Gorilla Grows were in berry patches, and I do remember it could have been just nostalgic, but there was just heirloom. We don't even know what the seeds were, but there was this wild aroma. It's very nostalgic, a very skunky kind of bear, and it was because we were hiding them. But I just love that idea, and we had a hillside in Happy Valley in Santa Cruz Mountains where we were trying to mitigate goat. We were in the ground and trying to work around these gophers. And somebody mentioned that the California poppy might be a nice, they don't like the roots or something. And so we had this interesting, flower patch mixed with the crop. And, they had a very interesting nose that year. And it's just a fun idea and to do studies and to think about the future of, you might want to consider the whole village of companions for the certain profiles you're looking for. It's a fascinating idea. It reminds me some of the biodynamic stuff too.
Definitely. And I think another thing to keep in mind is that, kind of a fun thought, I think, is that the most widely spoken language on our planet is terpene. And that's how biology and plants communicate with each other in a lot of different ways. There's more than just that, but plants will communicate to each other through volatile compounds, through aroma. And a lot of the time, these volatile compounds are also phytohormones. And these phytohormones will bring out responses in the plants that will affect their aromatic profiles and their aromatic, like, development. For example, I had mentioned jasmonic acid earlier. Jasmonic acid is named that because it is a volatile compound that is very dense in the jasmine flower. And the jasmine flower, you know, it smells, it's super strong, has a very distinct smell.
Yeah.
But plants next to jasmine flowers will be affected by the volatile compounds that jasmine flowers put off, and it will stimulate plant defenses and cellular division in the plants around them because it's a phytohormone. So there are a whole bunch of these phytohormones and these volatile compounds that plants communicate to each other with, a lot of which are studied, a lot of which that aren't fully understood. So when you have plants surrounding your plants, they're all affecting each other. You know, life affects life, right? So I always try to, I try to create, like, diversity, and I try to create, you know, I just try to nurture, like, a wide range of things if I can in my setup. And sometimes you have a particular setup where that's not possible. And sometimes you have a setup where it is very possible, but I just think it's a fun thought to play with. It's like how the plants surrounding your plants are all affecting each other through the root zone, through the compounds that they off-gas. And through, like, their fungal connections, how they communicate to each other through, like, fungal connections too.
Yeah.
It's just all super amazing.
Well, and that's, I would love to transition there, maybe speak a bit to the that symbiosis and the transportation and that relationship and your preferred ways of inoculating, or I kind of liked how you mentioned you were working with native plants and maybe native inoculates too is something to discuss.
Yeah, sure. So my favorite inoculant sources are insect-based. I try to integrate processes that nature integrates. So specifically earthworm castings and insect frass. These are what are referred to as mesophilic composting processes, where they're ingested by an insect, or these organic matter or plant matter is ingested by an insect. It runs through the insect's gut microbiome, and then it changes its composition, and it's now on the other end. It's an inoculant. We can use it as an inoculant, and it functions in the soil as such. Mesophilic means that it's within a particular temperature range, and I think it's between like 60 something to like mid 90s. I forget the exact numbers, but it's like a middle temperature range is what that means. And that's where the most biology can exist. When you go over these numbers, when you get up into your 100, your 110, your 120, 130 even, where thermal composting is done, we lose a lot of diversity of microorganisms. And different microorganisms will create different organic acids, which will then have a different effect on your plant. And that's not a bad thing. It's just a different thing. And my particular subscription to, you know, this concept is that I want to have as much diversity as possible. And then I want the environmental conditions and the soil composition to create a profile of biology that thrives in that particular climate and in that particular soil composition. So I nurture diversity, and then I let them kind of fight it out in the soil. So I like to use these mesophilic composting practices through insects, through insects. So earthworm castings, insect frass, I also like to use Bokashi, which I had mentioned before, which is a solid state ferment, which just means that it's not liquid. It's a grain carbohydrate that's inoculated with lactobacillus. And the lactobacillus's main intention is to keep pathogens from growing in this grain carbohydrate. Cause this grain, it is within its cellular structure, it holds this huge community of endophytes. Actinobacteria, actinomyces, streptomyces, pretty much every plant holds a similar expression of the soil it was grown in. So when you take a grain, it's going to have a lot of the components from the soil it was grown in. So it's important to get a grain that's cultivated locally or as locally as possible. This is where we get our lower fungi, right? Our lower fungi, they like to grow on this grain carbohydrate. And this is where we see our that fuzz, that mycelial network. It's not like a true mushroom fruiting body. It's a lower fungi. There's a lot of debate on what it is within the sustainable or regenerative agriculture community. I believe it to be Zygomycetes and Mucor, which a lot of the time people know this as cobweb mold, and they associate it a lot of the times with spoiled food. It's like what grows on your pasta when you leave it under the bed for too long. this kind of like hairy, funky stuff. People, you know, as humans, we associate things as good and bad. And, you know, we see spoiled food and we're like, that's bad. Spoiled food is bad. So this bacteria, this is bad bacteria. Or bad, you know, biology. But Mucor, Zygomycetes, they play a very important role in soil function. They actually have mycotransportation properties, and mycotransportation is the transportation of nutrients through fungal networks, through mycelium. There's a bunch of different fungal bodies, fungal networks, mycelium networks that do this. People are mostly think of mycorrhizae, right? And I think mycorrhizae has become pretty well understood in the cannabis community. But there's a lot of different fungal bodies that also perform mycotransportation and also create symbiotic relationships with mycorrhizae. So just for people who don't know what mycorrhizae is a particular fungal mycelium, fungal body that is symbiotic with roots and then increases the surface area of roots and the transportation of nutrients to those roots through the mycelial network that then forms a symbiotic relationship with the roots. So it can spread and go as far as like 200 yards. Nutrients can be transported like 200 yards from one nutrient source, like in a forest, and bring it to a root zone to a plant that needs nutrients, you know, super far distances. And this is how like old growth forests function. And you know, like you ever go walking in the woods and you're like, who waters these plants? Like who feeds these plants? Like how are they all so healthy and stuff? You know, because you have your house planted. You have your house plant in your house and it's like dying, right? And it's like, how are all these plants so happy all the time, right? And it's because they have all these really ancient processes that have evolved and communities within biology to function, one of which is mycorrhizal mycotransportation. This Mucor, right, from this Bokashi, I feel like I'm going all over the place. It creates a symbiotic relationship with mycorrhizae, right? To make the surface area even smaller and spread even further. And wow. this type of lower fungi, it grows, you know, faster, within like days. So you can mix a top dress, a nutrient source with Bokashi, Or you know, in the KNF community with IMO, we can get to that later. But and it myceliates with this fruiting body and creates this mycelial network. And now your mycorrhizae and your root zone have access to the nutrients with what you just top dressed almost immediately, very quickly. And so I always use Bokashi whenever I'm top dressing something, a nutrient source, and I like to add it to my earthworm castings and my insect fast, which is my biological inoculant, my input.
Wow.
Ooh, excuse me.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. So it's used as a top dress.
Yeah, it's in the top dress. You can add it to your soil mix also. But I use it as a top dress.
I love it. I love the worm casting piece too, and those little bioreactors, they do a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I just looked at the time, and we only have like a few minutes left.
I know. Isn't that how it goes? I knew it would go like this. Do you have any thoughts on varieties that you like to grow or steward? Or a lot of what we discuss on the show too is seeds and growing from seed and thinking about preservation, but also trying new things out, right? Exploring the potential of the genome. We'd love to hear your thoughts a little bit on taking care of this plant from seed.
So I love growing from seed. I do my own breeding. I'm currently working with a cheese genetic that I'm calling Lunar Cheese.
Yes.
I love cheeses. I love gases. I like skunk. I like funk. I like floral. I like earthy. You know, I just love weed. But what I'm playing with right now is like a very berry and cheesy expression that I'm having a lot of fun with. The taste is very like, it's very desserty, and I know like the dessert words are a big buzz in the cannabis industry right now, but this weed actually tastes like dessert. It tastes like raspberry cheesecake and like blueberry and peach cheesecake. So that's what I've been playing with a lot. It's a blue kryptonite on UK cheese. And blue kryptonite is DJ Shark's blueberry, which is, you know, a legendary genetic that was used to make like Blue Dream, and there's a few others I don't remember. And kryptonite, which is pretty rare, it's pretty old school. I don't think that the origins are known, but there's like, you know, like the Cottonmouth Kings used to like, you know, sing about it and stuff. But
it's legendary,
you know, and So I use blue kryptonite as a male onto UK cheese, which is this, it's actually a skunk one phenotype that had like a more cheesy expression to it. And so that's what I've been playing with lately. I released those seeds for a while. I've decided to not have them for sale at the moment. I want to make a fresh seed stock, and I'm working on some new varieties. So I will have that available in the future.
What do you look for? Yeah, when you say you're looking at or developing new varieties, we learned a little bit about your taste, but what do you look for when you're selecting male and female? Just like if you're exploring across, I'm always curious to hear what people are selecting for and how they go about that process.
So, in a male, you know, it's funny, you want something that's squatty, right? You want it to kind of grow like a female. You want it to be wider than it is tall. And that's something that I always kind of focused on, was wider than tall. And the genetics that I have now really show that. Like if you look on my Instagram profile, you'll see that my plants are like really, really wide. And not being top too. So I would always look for wider, you know, like a really wide plant that kind of created that like menorah shape, like a candelabra shape.
Cool, yeah.
I always look for like, you know, thickness of stalks, you know, the ability to hold, you know, to grow under their own weight, right? Of course, you want to try to find, like, you know, resistance to different infections. You know, like, sometimes you'll run into a plant that's just really susceptible to botrytis or to, like, spider mites. And so you want to, like, you know, look for things that aren't going to get sick. So if you're doing, like, a big pheno hunt, you'd be like, oh, this plant is sicker than this plant is, you know, like, you want to not use that one. And then also I like to kind of damage the tissue of the plant to bring out, like, its like terpenes, it's like volatile compounds or whatever, to see, like, what kind of aroma and how strong of an aroma it has, like, before you flower it. Because sometimes it's just not an option to bring everything that you have into flower. So that's kind of what I look for.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And, yeah, and the cheese, I love the cheese coming back. Is there, in your opinion, some cheeses, do they kind of express gassy? Because if you're growing a lot of different cheese from what you bred, I've had sweeter ones, but I've also had some gassy ones. I'm kind of curious if there's a relationship with cheese and skunk.
So cheese is a skunk. It
yeah,
actually is a
that's
skunk.
Kind of what I've heard. Phenotype. Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's a pheno. I see. Okay.
Yeah. So UK cheese is a phenotype of skunk one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? And it's just a different, you know, expression of the phenotypes, different phenotypical expression.
Yeah, it's fantastic. There's a lot of talk around skunk right now, so it's kind of fun to bring the cheese pheno into the mix.
Yeah, I'm liking the cheese aspect to kind of fade it out for a little bit. People get excited about things when they grow it a lot, and then they get burnt out on it, and then they move to something else, and then people forget about it for a while, and I'm trying to bring it back. I'm bringing back the cheese.
I support it. I can't wait. Well, we're at the top of the hour. We've got one more minute. I just wanted to give you the last word, and you could tell the audience how to continue this journey of education and discovery. Thank you. It's
yeah,
a great
absolutely.
Show. So super fun.
Hey, thank you so much. I hope I didn't rant too much. So yeah, you can find me on Instagram. I'm always open to teaching, and I'm always about open source information and spreading, you know, the information of how to do these things and create, like, real medicine for people and plant vigor. My handle is Luna All Day, but it shares an A. So it's LUNALLDAY. I just launched my Patreon also, so you can join and be a part of like the white papers that I share and the specific recipes that I use, the specific ferments that I make to bring out specific characteristics and to harness specific aspects.